This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We start the second book of the Torah, the book of Shemot. And interesting because whereas up till now we've dealt with the role that individual women have played, and that role has been substantial. Sorry, let's get rid of that. In this case, we're dealing with the role of women in general, and the Exodus, which is the subject of the whole first part of the Sefer. The heroines of the Exodus were the women. There is no part of the Torah where the women played as key a role in an event of national and universal importance as they did in the story of the Exodus, of the coming out of Egypt. Not only did they play an important role, but it wouldn't have happened without them. Not only wouldn't there have been an Exodus, there wouldn't have been a Jewish nation to bring out of Egypt. They were completely responsible, 100% responsible, for the survival of the Jewish people during that period in Egypt. And we'll see some of the ways in which they were responsible. Central to the story are two particular women, that the whole nation of women were exceptional in the way they functioned. The story, you know, that the king of Egypt started getting concerned about the numbers of Jews. They were multiplying, they were prominent, they were successful, and that's always the beginning of anti-Semitism throughout our history. That's been the issue. As we become more noticed, more prominent, and successful at what we're doing, there's an almost irrational fear of being taken over, of being threatened. And it's one of the things that raises concerns about the Jewish people in this country. As far as it seems that in such a free country one could have anything terrible happen, the prominence and success and activism of Jews in America has always been the forerunner of major anti-Semitism. So maybe this will be the first exception. No, but it's never been an exception before. And in the case of Egypt, it was not the first time either. It was the second time, really. It had happened in Yitzhak's time, really, with a small family, a small group of people. But the moment there's success and prominence, there is a concern and a fear among the people around and about. And he says these people are becoming too many. Let's start getting wise with them. And he enslaved them. And the more he enslaved them, kasher ya'anu, so the more he afflicted them, ken yirbe v'chen yifrut, so they would multiply even more. And they became afraid of the Jews. They embittered their lives still more, so it went on. And finally, the king comes with the final solution. Vayomer melech Mitzrayim lameyaldos ha'ivriyos. The king of Egypt called the Jewish midwives. Asher shem ho'achas shifro, the shem ha'shenis pur. The name of the one was Shifra, and the name of the other was Pua. Now clearly those weren't the only midwives. It was a big nation of people already. But they were the two chief midwives. They ran the midwife union. And Paro realized that whatever he would negotiate with them, the rest of the midwives would accept. Vayomer, and he said, Beyaledchem esoivrius, when you're helping to give birth to a Jewish birth, with the isem al avnoim, the moment you see on the birthstone, as they called it, im bein hu v'hamiten oso, if it's a son, you shall kill him, v'im basi v'choyim, if it's a daughter, you shall allow her to live. The Medrash comment was actually not such good advice. Who should he have killed? if you wanted to kill the girls, if you wanted to wipe out the nation, you should have killed the women. All you need is killing the men is not going to be. All you need is one man. If they say one man and 1,000 women, a couple of years later there can be 1,000 babies. But if there are no women, there are no babies. So why would he not go after the women? What was he driven for? Why did he go by the men? Because he'd seen astrologically that a man was going to challenge him. That there was going to be a Jewish leader that was going to arise, and therefore he thought his national interests were obscured, were confused by his personal interests of the upcoming conflict with Moshe. That's the instruction he gives to them. And then we're told the following: Vatireno hamayaldos eso Elohim. And the midwives feared God. Veloy osu kasher diber aleihem melech Mitzrayim. And they did not do as the king of Egypt spoke to them. Vatachayeno es hayelodim. And they kept the children alive. Vayikro melech Mitzrayim lamayaldos. So the king called the midwives. By Yom Elohim, and he said to them, Madua Ashlisem Adorazeh, why have you done this? That the Chayena for Yeladim, you're allowing the children to stay alive. Batomana Hamialdus or Paro, and the midwife said to Paro, Kiloi Kenoshim Hamitsriyot Haibriyot, because the Jewish women are not like Egyptian women. Kichayotain are their animals. But Terim Tovoalehim Amialedis for Yolodim, by the time we get there, they've had their babies already. This is no long labor period or anything, they're just CRISPRs. We get there too late. Why didn't Paro kill the midwives for not obeying him? The next set of midwives would have obeyed him. Why doesn't he punish them? He's given a decree, and they've defied him, and he does nothing about it. We'll see why. By Yetev Elohim Lamialdos, and God was good to the midwives. By Yirev Ha'om, and the nation multiplied. By Yatzmum Oedin, became very powerful. By Hiki Yoru Hamayaldos Yisrael Kim, and it was because the midwives feared God, by Yas Lohem Botim, that he created houses for them. And we'll see what that means. And then it says, when Pharaoh finally in despair instructed the nation, saying, any Jewish boy that you see, throw into the river. So again, he's after the males, but he then no longer left it to the midwives. He told his own nation to take care of that and to exterminate any Jewish males who were born.
Did they exterminate?
They did kill a lot. So they, the midwives' defiance of Paro is the first stated example that we have of the role the women played here. Had they not done so, and it clearly was a pain of death, had they not done so, the Jewish nation would have been obliterated very early on. Who are the midwives? So the Gemara tells us, and Rashi brings it, Shifra and Pura, that's not their real names. The name of Shifra was Yocheved, Moshe's mother, and Pura was Miriam, Moshe's sister. They were the two chief midwives, they were the women that did this. And why were they called Shifra and Pura? And they just give some interesting reasons. The word Shifro comes from Lishaper, which is to improve. And Shifro she didn't just give birth to the babies, she used to work on the babies and do physiotherapy on the babies and massage the babies and make sure that they were alive. In other words, she didn't just do her bit and say, well, the baby's born, that's up to God and I'm out of here before Paro comes or the policeman comes. She would stay with the child, and she would make sure that the child was viable and that had overcome the difficulties of birth and so on. So she was known by her professional name, Shifra. That was her role. But not only did she play the midwifing role, but she went beyond that to being Meshaperet et Havlad. She actually worked with the baby and made the baby as strong as she could in the time that she was there. And Pua was Miriam, and Rashi says, why is she called Pua? She Pua umedaberis bohogala yelid. Pua is like an illiterate sound, like poo 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 poo, you know, but she used to play, she used to talk to the child, and communicate with the child. So there again, you see the love, you see the caring. This was not, they didn't withdrawal, just do the functional job. They went far beyond that. And they had a love for every baby that was born, and they had an attachment to every baby that was born, and they invested in every baby that was born. They did exactly the opposite of what Paro wanted them to do. And as it says there, that they did not listen to the king of Israel, of Egypt. They did not do as the king of Egypt had requested of them or demanded of them. And they gave life. The little translation is, and they kept the children alive. The Gemara says, why do you have to tell us that? If it simply says that they disobeyed the king, we know that means that they did not kill the children. Gemara says it's not about not killing. That's not what these women were great for. What these women were great for was about the chayeno, the life they gave to these children. Not only did they not kill the children, but they invested life in the children. They were responsible for the growth of the children, for the survival of the children during those early hours. And we know today that those early hours are critical, not only for the physical development of the child, but even for the emotional development of the child. That the baby's perceptive abilities during the first 2 hours or so are far beyond anything it will have for several months. It can see absolutely clearly, it can hear absolutely clearly, and then it loses it after a couple of hours. And then it slowly starts coming back. And that's why now, I'm sure it's here as well, certainly in South Africa, years ago, they already realized the importance of leaving the baby with the mother for those first 2 hours. Because there's an attachment, there's a bonding that takes place during those first 2 hours. In the old days, they used to take the baby away to give the mother a rest. I don't know if the mother did have a rest or didn't, but probably worrying about how many toes the baby had and how many fingers the baby had, and is the baby still alive, and why haven't they brought the baby back? I don't know if the mother even had a rest. Certainly in South Africa, how is it here? They don't do that anymore. They leave the, they took it away. And nowadays, does anybody know what they do? What they do now? They give the baby to the mother for that.
It depends. You know, if you're really busy, they just forget you. And
that's great.
And then they come back and get us later.
Yeah, that's great. No, in South Africa, in the better places, they bring you tea and coffee, and they leave the baby, and you have a cat. Yeah, they used to. I don't know about now, but because they realized that the work had been done, and they realized that was an incredibly important time for mother, father, baby, for everybody, and that the baby was a participant, that the baby could participate. You see, the Torah, that's known. The Shifra and Pua, what they did was those 2 hours they invested in the child. Now, what's interesting also is it doesn't have to be the mother. Of course, there's a bonding thing that takes place, but what's important to a baby is not the mother. The baby doesn't recognize the mother until several months later. As long as it's a mother figure. A loving midwife can do as much for the baby as a mother and can do a whole lot more than a non-loving mother. A warm midwife is far more important to the baby than a cold mother. That was the role of the midwife. The midwife was not just to help with the medical process. The Jewish midwifery was to mother the child so that the mother didn't have to do that. And the idea of a wet nurse, what was the idea of a wet nurse? It wasn't just because the mother couldn't give milk. That wasn't the issue. It wasn't necessary for the mother to do that. And they had wet nurses, and the idea of the wet nurse was not just to provide milk. The idea of the wet nurse was to mother the baby, so the mother wouldn't have to mother. The baby doesn't need the mother. The baby needs a mother. And it's only later on that the child, when the child's a teenager, then the child needs its mother. And what usually happens is mothers think, oh, poor little baby, the baby needs me, the baby needs me. A teenager is independent, he can stand on his own 2 feet. No. When the baby's a baby, the baby doesn't need you at all. All the baby needs is a mother. When the baby is a big baby, is a teenager, really, the baby needs a mother desperately, and nobody else will do. And that's it. That's an understanding that we've missed altogether. I used to do it quite cruelly to some mothers, I think I've told you. But when they used to get very excited about the baby smiled at me. And then you take a big picture of a smiley face and you hold it up to the baby and the baby smiles just the same. It's not the baby smiling at the mother, it's the baby smiling at warmth, the baby smiling at recognition. As long as it's getting that warmth, it doesn't matter that much from who, other than from the mother's perspective. She might want to mother the child, and that's fine, and she's playing midwife. But it's not a role she has to play, as long as there's somebody there to play that role. And that's what they're praised, not just for defying the king. That's one thing they did, they defied the king. But what's really important is that under these difficult circumstances, they invested the children with life. Why doesn't he kill them? The Gemara says a strange thing. Medrash brings it as well. The grammar here is peculiar. It should say, "V'loy otzu kasher diber lohen melech Mitzrayim," and they did not do as the king said to them. "Diber alehen melech Mitzrayim," instead of "diber lohen," that "alehen" word is a quite an intimate word. "Alehen" means he spoke intimately with them. "Diber lohen" means he instructed them. There's a nuance of meaning that is quite interesting. And Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina says, "Melameid shetova san lehizdaveg lohem." That part of this whole process was that he demanded that they have relations with him. This was not so. He had a whole thing going with Yocheved and Miriam that was beyond just this instruction. "Veloy kiblu mimenu," and they would have none of it. So when it says "V'loy osu kasher diber alehem melech Mitzrayim," and they did not do as the king of Egypt was trying to persuade them to do, it's talking not only about his instruction with regard to exterminating the boys, but also in terms of that relationship. What's difficult about that is the praise. Yeah, you've got which women? Well, who are we talking about? Yocheved and Miriam, two of the greatest Jewish women that have ever lived, Moshe's mother and Moshe's sister. Both of them responsible for the creation and saving of the nation of Israel. You're talking about the greatest rebbetzins that have ever been. And the Torah praises them. You know what? They didn't have an affair with Paro. Isn't that great? Isn't that incredible? Why is that incredible? That they defied his instruction and could have been killed for that? Understand that. That's great. Especially the way they did it. We wouldn't have expected them to murder the children, but we wouldn't have expected them to go so far beyond their duties in defiance of Paro. That one understands. But what is the Torah implying? Some level of praise for them. And furthermore, it says, "Vatireno hamiyaldos eso elokim v'lo yasu kasher diber alehem melech Mitzrayim," and the midwives feared God and did not do as the king engaged with them to do. And if they didn't fear God, would they? It was the implication that anybody who doesn't fear God would have. Is this an element of God-fearing, or was this just basic morality? What would have been the issue? Both of them were married women. The implication is that the power and the charisma and the strength and the force involved in that position, never mind in the personality of Paro, but even just in the position of Paro, would under normal circumstances have made it very difficult for them to resist. And it was their God-fearingness in a sense that gave them the ability to do so. And that brings into question the relationship between God-fearing and moral. Can the one exist without the other? Can you be God-fearing and not moral? Can you be moral and not God-fearing? So can you be God-fearing and not moral now? You cannot, is that right?
Yes.
But you cannot be God-fearing and not moral.
You cannot be what? You have to be moral. That is moral.
You have to be moral. Does everybody agree with that? If you're naturally moral, you don't have to be God-fearing. If you're naturally moral, you would argue that it has nothing to do with being God-fearing. If it's natural. Why not? Well, that's just you're an obstinate. Why would you say that it's not necessarily so? Okay, so let's take it a bit further and understand what God-fearing means. Is God-fear a value?
Yes.
belief in God is a value. What is God fear? So if there's true fear of God, and if you fear the heat of a fire, are you going to put your hand in no matter how cold you are?
Yeah.
You're instinctively cold, so you want to get drawn to a fire. Moths fly right into the flame. Are you going to do that? No, because the instinctive fear of the fire is greater than the desire for warmth. So you're not going to do that. Things that you're really afraid of, you don't do. God-fearing doesn't mean believing in God. God-fearing doesn't mean an intellectual understanding of God. God-fearing means I am so terrified of disobeying Him that it's not even a question of choice. And that's why God-fearing is a level far beyond belief and far beyond understanding. It's where God becomes such a reality that the fear doesn't mean you go around with fear. It just means like you don't go around afraid of fire all the time. It just means that you respect it. You know its power and you won't play around with it. That's what God-fearing means. That it is so, that the reality of it is so complete in one's understanding and one's feeling and one's intuition that whatever intuitive desires one has to disobey that will are counterbalanced by a stronger issue. And that's why very few people are God-fearing. Lots of people are religious and lots of people believe in God and all of those good things, but very few people are God-fearing. A God-fearing person is a person who never does wrong. Because if one does wrong knowingly, even if not always deliberately, but if one does wrong knowingly, there has to be not a diminishment of one's belief in God. One can believe in God 100% and still do wrong. But God-fearing is an element where the reality of God is not a concept, God is not an idea, God is not a belief. It's a reality. You know, doing this, I fall off the cliff. So I don't do it. I don't care how nice it looks and how good it is. I don't do it. Don't go that far. And you know what? Not only don't I do that, I put up a fence there to make sure that in the night time, by mistake, I don't fall over the cliff. And if it's a rickety fence, I might put on two fences to make sure that my kids don't fall off the cliff. That's what you do if you know there's a cliff. And God-fearing means there's a cliff. And most people are not God-fearing. God is too remote, too distant. It's very difficult to be God-fearing. It's a term we use lightly, but it isn't a light term. To translate that abstract into a reality, and it's not a fake reality, not an illusionary reality, but a reality is something that very few people are capable of doing. Shifron Pua had it. That was one of the few people that had it where the Torah says about them. The Torah doesn't use this phrase very often, but they were God-fearing. These people were God-fearing.
Carl knows that Yocheved had been nursing Moshe.
Did she know that it was Yocheved?
Yeah, that it was nursing him.
As Bela, this is later on already.
I know, but did he know? Oh, like, was he familiar with her? Did I mean, were they kind of like? Was she
that's an interesting question. I don't know, because then how does the story unfold when Yocheved is brought in as a witness? If he didn't know, it could be that she was in those days modesty implied, like in the Muslim countries today. It could be that then that he never saw her face. And even when she came to nurse Moshe, that he actually didn't know who she was. It could be that is a possibility. So the God fearingness is what keeps them out of any kind of possibility of doing anything wrong. Which means that without that God fearingness, as great a woman as they are, there would be a potential for misconduct with power. And why would that be, and how does the God-fearingness deal with that? It doesn't seem so much as a matter of there might be that element of it, that it's a matter of fear, that the king, the power of the king and the fear of what he could do with it and the fear of God was greater. Or it could be the affirmation of what it is to a person. That the most powerful person in the world at that time, that was the most powerful person in Egypt. Egypt was the leading nation of the world at that time. Paro was the most powerful person in the world, and he was powerful, not as powerful as presidents of this country are. That's not the kind of power he had. He had the power of the executive, the judiciary, and the legislature all in one person with no checks and balances. That was his power. And for a woman to be desired by a man who has that power is difficult to resist, because there's a natural insecurity in everybody. And the method of securing it is a relationship with God, in a sense. That, yes, a lot of people have an internal morality, but what is that internal morality at the end of the day? Is an internal morality not a linking in to that which is spiritual and that which is true and that which is correct? But even an internal morality can be fractured if there is no fear of consequence as far as God is concerned. That even there could be the people as great as Miriam and Yocheved, Shifra and Pua, there was the potential Paro could break them down, would have been able to break them down, and didn't because of that relationship that they had with God. And the relationship with God is what brings them not only to say no to Him, not only to defy Him, but to invest all of that love and care in the children of all. And they understand that's what God wants of them. That is their mission in life, and Paro is not part of that. What their opportunity for greatness is right now is to invest in the quality of these children who are being born at this time, because this is the future of the Jewish people. And that if there's strength in the children, there will be a possibility of a future. If there isn't strength in the children, there won't. And who has the opportunity of giving that strength? They do, and for that they are commended. No, this was just preceding that time. That's one of the reasons that she's called Pua, in fact, is given for that. And because Pua also means Sheho, the Medrash says Sheho Fio Ponim Keneged Ovi, or she challenged her father. Hofio means she stood up to. So the one meaning of Pua is that she poo-pooed at the babies, and the other one is that there was enormous strength of character that she stood up to Paro and she stood up to her father. The case of standing up to her father, the Medrash tells us that very story. Shehayo Amram Rosh Sanhedrin, Bois Osho. At that time, Amram, Moshe's father, was the chief of the Sanhedrin. So this was the biggest, the greatest rabbinic authority was Amram. Kivan Shegoza Paro Voma Kol HaBen HaYolod. When Paro made the decree that every Jewish baby will be thrown into the river, Omar Amram, Amram said, V'lareik Yisroel Molidim. That means the Jews are going to have children for nothing. God has gone too far. And there's no point in bringing children into the world that are going to be destroyed. Immediately he divorced, he separated from Yocheved. He had no sexual interaction with anybody. And she divorced Yocheved when Yocheved was 3 months pregnant. With who? Who was she pregnant with? With Aaron. Miriam was already born. She was pregnant with Aaron. Omdu kol Yisrael v'gushes nashosayim. The Jews saw what the head of the Sanhedrin had done, and without a question, everybody divorced their wives. But they realized that there was no other means of contraception available to them, and that's what they did. Omru loy, Ito, his daughter, Miriam, Pua, said to him, Gezerosho koshe mishol paro. Your decree is more cruel than Pharaoh's, she said to her father. Paro simply stopped the Jewish boys. We're killing Jewish boys. You're killing boys and girls. You're not allowing any future at all, so you're going further than Paro. Paro is a Rasha, we know that. He's a wicked man. And therefore we're not sure that God is really going to give credence to his decree. He doesn't have the moral force that necessarily is going to work out the way he thinks. I'm a tzaddik, but you're a tzaddik. And if you decree, God listens. That's the answer. So tzaddik makes a decree, even if it's a wrong one, God listens. Omadu he accepted it and remarried his wife. Omdu called Yisrael v'Yisrael, and everybody else then remarried, married their wives. And the result of her challenging her father was the birth of Moshe. Had she not challenged her father, there would have been no Moshe. Which again says so much for the role of authority and challenge in our lives. Yes, there's a strong authority, there's a parental authority, there's a rabbinic authority, there's a royal authority, there are all sorts of authorities. I mentioned the Gemara Shiur this morning. The only time that statements are made in a way that doesn't invite question and debate is in the Chumash, when God makes statements. In the Mishnah, in the Gemara, whenever there's a rabbinic statement of law, it's formatted in a way that compels questioning and discussion. And yet the questioning reaches resolution at the end of the law, and the law is binding. But the process of getting there is one that involves questioning. Here's a father and a mother, they've made a decision. The decision is, this is a Rosh Sanhedrin. Imagine what it was for her to stand up to her father, who is also the head of the Sanhedrin, and say to him, you're worse than Paro. What you're doing is more serious than Paro. And for her to argue that through with him, and of course the greatness of Amram, as the Rosh of Sanhedrin, to publicly say, I made a halachic and a personal error, and my daughter pointed it out to me. And to set the trend of reversing his decision and getting everybody else to reverse their decision, and the outcome of that is Paro. Without that little interaction between father and daughter, the outcome of Moshe, without that little interaction, there would have been no future of the Jewish people. So once again we see the woman being responsible, Miriam challenging her father. It was not Amram, the head of the Sanhedrin, who saved the Jewish nation. It was Miriam who challenged the head of the Sanhedrin to save the Jewish nation. And so with the two of them there.
It was Amram who had to listen to
it. Yes. That's
right. Is
No, she's a descendant of Levi. Yes. Doesn't say that in the Hebrew. He doesn't say babies. He means
no. He doesn't say
the Jewish babies.
Jewish. No.
It's interesting. Unkelus makes that clear and deals with that in his translation. It says, "Kol berod yisyalid leYehudai." The instruction was every child, every boy that will be born to the Jewish people. So why the Torah doesn't frame it that way, whether it just takes for granted that that's what we're talking about, or whether there's any meaning in that, I'm not sure. You're right, the way it's worded is that he just says any boy, but that was not that was not the essence of his instruction. The other area in which the Jewish women are praised, the Gemara says the following. Darash Rav Aviro had learned, Bischar Noshim Tzidkaniyo Shoyubo Isohador. It is because of the righteous women of that generation that Nigalu Yisroel Mitzrayim, that the Jews were redeemed from Egypt. What did they do? Bashor Shehochus Lishov Mayim, when the women used to go and draw water from the wells, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mezamein Lohem Dagim Ketanim B'chadehem. God arranged that there were little fishes that used to come up in the water as well. They went for water, but there was protein in the water as well. There were little fish. The shav is mechza mayim or mechza dagim. And they would land up with a bucket with half fish and half water. What did they do? A voice for shoyfto shtei kederis. They would then take two buckets. So they're in the village, the men are out working, laboring in the fields and in the building sites. The women would take these two buckets, achas shel chamin v'achas shel dagim. They would take a bucket of fish and the other hot water. They would then go and heat the water and schlep these two buckets out, a bucket of fish and a bucket of water. Uvoyis, and umalichas etzol ba'aleihim lasodeh, and they would take it to their husbands in the field. And what did they do in the field? Umalchit sois oisom. They would bathe their husbands. The sakos oison, they would massage them. Umachilos oison, and they would feed them. Mashkos oison, and they would give them to drink. And look at the order. How often does a woman think that the most important thing when her husband comes home from work is what? Have stuff already on the table. First, bathed him, and he's hungry, he's a slave, he's been working. Doesn't matter. She bathes him, she makes him fuss with him, she reestablishes his own self-esteem. He's been treated as a slave, and realize who these people were. One of the real shockers of the Holocaust, I found as a child, and even now, are those films that show footage of the transition of people, and there's very little footage of it, in their normal lives, being taken off, and then those same people in the concentration camp. And one exhibit that does it very well is the exhibit at the Washington Holocaust Museum, which they had here for a while. I don't know if everybody saw it. I think that the story of Daniel or something it was called, where you actually walked through those few days of his life from a middle-class German home, and you saw a child, and you walked into his bedroom and his little toys and his things and his clothes and his bed and where he lived as a child, and you moved through the transition, which only took a few days, from that comfort and security into a filthy concentration camp cell shared with hundreds or tens of other people. Because sometimes, you know, you look at the concentration in there and you say, well, that's sad and all that. But to actually think that these were people of enormous dignity days beforehand. These were leaders. These were successful business people. These were teachers. These were rabbis. These were people who'd lived lives of enormous dignity. So think what these men were like. These men had lived in Egypt as successful, high-profile people, and all of a sudden they're slaves being abused by the lowest of the low of Egyptian society. What do the wives say is their primary role here if they're going to, if the Jewish people are going to survive? What are they going to need to do? So let's take it to its lowest common denominator. They're going to need to have babies. Are these men capable of having sexual relationships with their wives? Are there going to be any babies? So what do? They realize that the first thing they've got to do is preserve the dignity of these men, is make them feel special, make them feel valuable, make them feel important. How do you do that to a slave? That was her role. As much as she slept the bucket of fish, in the other hand was a bucket of hot water. And she used the hot water first to bathe them, to spoil them, to make them feel beautiful. Then they gave them to eat and drink. By that time, they were already a little bit more relaxed. So the purpose of eating now is no longer just, I'm hungry, give me something to eat. Now there's already a bit of a relationship. They're a little bit relaxed. They can sit and have a quiet dinner, or dinner, fish from the well, sardines or something, whatever they were able to pick up from the well. But it didn't matter. There was already something was taking place between them. Then his caucus lay in bent for Simon. Then they would go off between the fields. There were walls. There were fences and walls between the fields, so there was some level of privacy. And they used to have relations in the fields. And that's how they had babies. Why didn't they wait till night time, till the men came home? Be too tired by then. They realized it wouldn't happen. It wouldn't happen. The only way they could do it is siesta time. The Europeans know that the quality of that, but night time is not the time for families to be together and for men and women to. People are too tired in the night time. The Europeans understand that you break your work, take off, work late at night. You can work late at night, but start later in the morning, do whatever you need to do. But you need something in the middle of the day. You can't work a whole day and have a romantic night. That's not going to happen. And so they've preserved this kind of thing. The Jews understood there had to be a siesta, there had to be a midday breaking off to be able to do this. And they praised for that the sensitivity, the care, the thought that they did. They didn't just go after, we must have babies. No, they understood. Having babies means having a successful relationship. The babies are the outcome of a successful relationship. Having a successful relationship is having a man who's proud and who has dignity. The dignity is having the dignity fed and nourished by the woman with whom he's supposed to be having the relationship. And the outcome of that are the babies and the children. And for that, they're praised for their understanding of that. Of course, the other area that we know that they used, that God approved of so enormously, was the copper mirrors. That they used to take copper mirrors, polished shiny copper, and when they used to sit and they were having lunch with their husbands and they were talking, they would take the mirror out and they would look at themselves in the mirror and show their images to their husbands and talk about, look what a pretty girl she is. And why is that? Why was that so important? Because sometimes photographs are much better than the reality. There's a kind of objective, and you're only seeing part, and you can it creates a distance that removes. I don't know what it does, but it objectifies it to some degree, and they start kidding around, and they start laughing about it. It creates a nice atmosphere, and that helped the relaxation, and that helped the love and the affection. And enable them to continue having a relationship. What did God do with those mirrors? The mirrors that were used in the bedroom to encourage good sexual relationships, that became the washing basin of the high priest of the Kohanim, the Beis HaMikdash. God said, that's where I want that to be. The way the women used that to enhance their femininity, and with that to keep the relationships going, it could produce another generation of children that enabled God to take them out. So notice what the women in all these cases have done. They are the heroines, but they've done it not by trying to be men. In all cases, they've been the heroines by using their femininity to the full, using their femininity to the maximum. Shifra and Puah being the mother figures for the little babies, the women being good women, good wives, establishing good relationships with their husbands as women, not trying to do anything other than what they're really good at and maximizing their femininity, not allowing the hardships and the slavery of Egypt to undermine that femininity and to allow it to be destroyed, and to use that femininity to nourish their husbands and their relationships with them.
Was someone leading them? And I mean, if they're all using their copper mirrors and they're all doing these sort of same things, who's telling them, who's guiding them?
You know, how does it work with fashion? Some new thing comes out in the fashion, all of a sudden all the women are wearing it very quickly. People, as much as people try to be independent, there's a limit with women in that there's an independence. When something good comes out, everybody wants it and does it. Isn't that so? When something good comes out, if fashion is bad, people don't do it, it fails. But if something good comes out, it doesn't take very long for people to catch on to that. So whether there was somebody leading or different things, different people tried and it just seemed to work. And if something's working for you, for this person, surely somebody else will try. That's the way it happens.